Chapter 3. Two Approaches to Learning. As you can probably sense, the scholastic chess world is a deadly place. Every year, thousands of boys and girls put their hearts on the line, each child believing he or she may be the best. Glory is a powerful incentive. Inevitably, dreams are dashed, hearts are broken. Most fall short of their expectations because there's little room at the top. Of course, this dynamic can be found in virtually any ambitious field. Little league athletes dream of playing for their favorite major league team. Kids shooting hoops in the schoolyards want to be like Mike. The world of actors and musicians is brimming with huge expectations, wild competitiveness, and a tiny window of realistic possibility. Two questions arise. First, what is the difference that allows some to fit into that narrow window to the top? And second, what's the point? If ambition spells probable disappointment, why pursue excellence? In my opinion, the answer to both questions lies in a well-thought-out approach that inspires resilience, the ability to make connections between diverse life pursuits, and day-to-day enjoyment of the process. The vast majority of motivated people, young and old, make terrible mistakes in their approach to learning. They fall frustrated by the wayside, while those on the road to success keep steady on their paths. Developmental psychologists have done extensive research on the effects of a student's approach on his or her ability to learn and ultimately master material. Dr. Carl Dweck, a leading researcher in the field of developmental psychology, makes the distinction between entity and incremental theories of intelligence. Children who are entity theorists, that is, kids who have been influenced by their parents and teachers to think in this manner, are prone to use language like, "I'm smart at this," and to attribute their success or failure to an ingrained and unalterable level of ability. They see their overall intelligence or skill level at a certain discipline to be a fixed entity, a thing that cannot evolve. Incremental theorists, who have picked up a different modality of learning, let's call them learning theorists, are more prone to describe their results with sentences like, "I got it because I worked very hard at it," or "I should have tried harder." A child with a learning theory of intelligence tends to sense that with hard work, difficult material can be grasped. Step by step, incrementally, the novice can become the master. Dweck's research has shown that when challenged by difficult material, learning theorists are far more likely to rise to the level of the game, while entity theorists are more brittle and prone to quit. Children who associate success with hard work tend to have a mastery-oriented response to challenging situations, while children who see themselves as just plain smart or dumb or good or bad at something have a learned helplessness orientation. In one wonderfully revealing study, a group of children was interviewed, and then each child was noted as having either an entity or learning theory of intelligence. All the children were then given a series of easy math problems, which they all solved correctly. Then, all the children were given some very hard problems to solve, problems that were too difficult for them. It was clear that the learning theorists were excited by the challenge, while the entity theorists were dismayed. Comments would range from, "Oh boy, now I'm going to really have to try hard," to, "I'm not smart enough for this." Everyone got these problems wrong, but evidently the experience of being challenged had very different effects. What is most interesting is the third stage of this experiment. All the children were once again given easy problems to solve. Nearly all of the learning theorists breezed right through the easy material, but the entity theorists had been so dispirited by the inability to solve the hard problems that many of them foundered through the easy stuff. Their self-confidence had been destroyed. What's compelling about this is that the results have nothing to do with intelligence level. Very smart kids with entity theories tend to be far more brittle when challenged than kids with learning theories who'd be considered not quite as sharp. In fact, some of the brightest kids prove to be the most vulnerable to becoming helpless, because they feel the need to live up to and maintain a perfectionist image that's easily and inevitably shattered. As an observer of countless talented young chess players, I can vouch for the accuracy of this point. Some of the most gifted players are the worst under pressure, and have the hardest time rebounding from defeat. How are these theories of intelligence programmed into our minds? Often, subtle differences in parental or instructional style can make a huge difference. Entity theorists tend to have been told that they did well when they've succeeded, and that they weren't any good at something when they failed. So, a kid aces a math test, comes home, and hears, "Wow, that's my boy, as smart as they come." Then next week, Johnny fails an English test, and hears, "What's wrong with you? Can't you read?" Or, "Your mommy never liked reading either. Obviously, it's not your thing." So the boy figures he's good at math and bad at English, and what's more, he links success and failure to ingrained ability. Learning theorists, on the other hand, are given feedback that's more process-oriented, After doing well in an English essay, a little girl might be congratulated by her teacher with, "Wow, great job, Julie. You're really becoming a wonderful writer. Keep up the good work." And if she does badly on a math test, her teacher might write, "Study a little harder for the next one, and you'll do great. And feel free to ask me questions anytime after class. That's what I'm here for." So Julie learns to associate effort with success, and feels that she can become good at anything with some hard work. She also feels as though she's on a journey of learning, and her teacher is a friendly assistant in her growth. Johnny thinks he's good at math and bad at English, and he focuses on quick results as opposed to long-term process. But what happens when he does badly on a hard math test down the line? Will he be prepared to learn the right lessons from life's inevitable challenges? Unfortunately, he may not. It's clear that parents and teachers have an enormous responsibility in forming the theories of intelligence of their students and children, and it's never too late. It's critical to realize that we can always evolve in our approaches to learning. Studies have shown that in just minutes, kids can be conditioned into having a healthy learning theory for a given situation. In one study, children were given different instructions about what the aim of their task was. Some kids were told that solving certain problems would help them with their schoolwork in the future, and other kids were told that they'd be judged based on their results. In other words, half the kids received mastery-oriented instructions, and half the kids received helplessness-producing instructions. Needless to say, the kids who were temporarily mastery-oriented did much better on the tests. So, how does all this affect us in our day-to-day lives? Fundamentally, the key to pursuing excellence is to embrace an organic, long-term learning process and not to live in a shell of static, safe mediocrity. Usually, growth comes at the expense of previous comfort or safety. The hermit crab is a colorful example of a creature that lives by this aspect of the growth process, albeit without our psychological baggage. As the crab gets bigger, it needs to find a more spacious shell, so the slow, lumbering creature goes on a quest for a new home. If an appropriate new shell is not found quickly, a terribly delicate moment of truth arises. A soft creature that's used to the protection of built-in armor must now go out into the world, exposed to predators in all its mushy vulnerability. That learning phase in between shells is where our growth can spring from. Someone stuck with an entity theory of intelligence is like an anorexic hermit crab, starving itself so it doesn't grow to have to find a new shell. In my experience, successful people shoot for the stars, put their hearts on the line in every battle, and ultimately discover that the lessons learned from the pursuit of excellence mean much more than the immediate trophies and glory. In the long run, painful losses may prove much more valuable than wins. Those who are armed with a healthy attitude and are able to draw wisdom from every experience, good or bad, are the ones who make it down the road. They are also the ones who are happier along the way. Of course, the real challenge is to stay in range of this long-term perspective when you're under fire and hurting in the middle of the war. This, maybe our biggest hurdle, is at the core of the art of learning. Let's return to the scholastic chess world and focus on the ingredients to my early success. I mentioned that Bruce and I studied the endgame, while other young players focused on the opening. In light of the entity incremental discussion, I'd like to plunge a little more deeply into the approach that Bruce and I adopted. Rewind to those days when I was a 6-year-old prankster. Once he had won my confidence, Bruce began our study with a barren chessboard. We took on positions of reduced complexity and clear principles. Our first focus was king and pawn against king, just 3 pieces on the table. Over time, I gained an excellent intuitive feel for the power of the king and the subtlety of the pawn. I learned the principle of opposition, the hidden potency of empty space, the idea of zugzwang, putting your opponent in a position where any move he makes will destroy his position. Layer by layer, we built up my knowledge and my understanding of how to transform axioms into fuel for creative insight. Then we turned to rook endings, bishop endings, knight endings, spending hundreds of hours as I turned 7 and 8 years old, exploring the operating principles behind positions that I might never see again. This method of study gave me a feeling for the beautiful subtleties of each chess piece, because in relatively clear-cut positions I could focus on what was essential. I was also gradually internalizing a marvelous methodology of learning, the play between knowledge, intuition, and creativity. From both educational and technical perspectives, I learned from the foundation up. Most of my rivals, on the other hand, began by studying opening variations. There is a vast body of theory that begins from the starting position of all chess games, and it's very tempting to teach children openings right off the bat, because built into this theoretical part of the game, there are many embedded traps, landmines, that allow a player to win quickly and easily. In effect, to win without having to struggle to win. At first thought, it seems logical for a novice to study positions that he or she will see all the time at the outset of games. Why not begin from the beginning, especially if it leads to instant success? The answer is quicksand. Once you start with openings, there's no way out. Lifetimes can be spent memorizing and keeping up with the evolving encyclopedia of chess openings. They are an addiction, with perilous psychological effects. It's a little like developing the habit of stealing the test from your teacher's desk, instead of learning how to do the math. You may pass the test, but you learn absolutely nothing, and most critically, you don't get an appreciation for the value or beauty in learning itself. For children who focus early on openings, chess becomes about results, period. It doesn't matter how you played, or if you concentrated well, or if you were brave. These kids talk about the four-move mate, and ask each other, how many moves did it take you to win? Chess becomes one-dimensional, winning, and winning fast. Children who begin their chess education by memorizing openings tend to internalize an entity theory of intelligence. Their dialogues with teachers, parents, and other children are all about results, not effort. They consider themselves winners because so far they have won. In school, they focus on what comes easy to them and ignore the subjects that are harder. On the playground, they use the famous, "I wasn't trying," after missing a shot or striking out. Once I was in Arizona giving a lecture on simultaneous exhibition to a large group of young chess players and parents, and the organizer of the event picked me up at the airport bragging that his son hadn't lost a chess game in over a year. Obviously, this was a record the whole family was proud of. I knew it was coming. Classic anorexic hermit crab. When I met the child, he was a moderately talented boy who was the best in his school. He had learned some quick opening attacks and had a natural feel for basic chess tactics. Clearly, he had started winning and that had been praised effusively for his genius. As a result, the boy refused to play anyone outside of the circle of friends and competitors whom he knew to be inferior. His favorite opponent was his father, who was a weak player and no challenge at all. To his school buddies, this boy was a chess god, but compared to serious chess-playing children around the country, he had a long way to go. He was a big fish in a small pond, and he liked it that way. The boy avoided chess throughout my visit. He didn't want to play in the simultaneous exhibition, and was the only child at the event who was resistant to instruction. His winning streak and the constant talk of it had him all locked up. He was terrified of shattering the facade of perfection. This child was paralyzed by an ever-deepening cycle of entity indoctrination. Many kids like this are quite talented, so they excel at first because of good genes, but then they hit a roadblock. As chess struggles become more intense and opponents put up serious resistance, they start to lose interest in the game. They try to avoid challenges, but eventually the real world finds them. Their confidence is fragile. Losing is always a crisis instead of an opportunity for growth. If they were a winner because they won, this new losing must make them a loser. The long-term effects of opening madness are clear, but there are also serious immediate weaknesses in young chess players brought up in this environment. Just as there are inevitable ups and downs in a career, there are also momentum shifts in individual games. Most of my early rivals were gifted children, and they are prepared with hundreds of traps with which they could win right off the bat. Playing against these kids was like walking through a minefield, but I was good enough on my feet to navigate most of the danger. I often came out of the openings in a little bit of trouble, but then I took control. As our games progressed, my opponents moved away from their area of comfort, while I grew stronger and more confident. They wanted to win before the battle began, but I loved the struggle that was the heart of chess. In both the short term and the long term, these kids were crippled by the horizon imposed on them by their teachers. The problem in the chess world is that many coaches work in schools with an ever-replenishing annual supply of talented young children. These kids are like raw material in a factory. Each year the teachers are expected to provide results because having a nationally ranked chess team is prestigious for the school. So the coaches create a legion of entity-theorizing, tactically gifted young chess players who are armed to the teeth with a brutal opening repertoire. It doesn't matter if these kids will hit a crisis in seventh grade, because all that counts for the coach are the primary and elementary school divisions, and there are always more first graders coming up the pipe. Clearly, parents bear an enormous responsibility in navigating these issues and choosing the right teacher for their child. I've used chess to illustrate this entity-incremental dynamic, but the issue is fundamental to the pursuit of excellence in all fields. If a young basketball player is taught that winning is the only thing that winners do, then he'll crumble when he misses his first big shot. If a gymnast or ballet dancer is taught that her self-worth is entirely wrapped up in a perfectly skinny body that's always ready for performance, then how can she handle injuries or life after an inevitably short career? If a business person cultivates a perfectionist self-image, then how can she learn from her mistakes? When I reflect back on my chess career, I remember the losses and the lessons learned from defeat. I remember losing that first national championship to David Arnett. I remember being crushed by my arch rival in a sudden-death playoff of the U.S. Junior Under-21 Championship, a year before I won the tournament outright. Then there was the final round of the Under-18 World Chess Championship in Szeged, Hungary. I was on board one, competing against the Russian for the world title. Inches from a life's dream, I was offered a draw, a chance to share the glory. All I had to do was shake hands, but I declined, pushed for a win, and lost. Such agony. These moments in my life were racked with pain, but they were also defining gut checks packed with potential. The setbacks taught me how to succeed. And what kept me on my path was a love for learning that has its roots in my first chess lessons as a 6-year-old boy. Chapter 4. Loving the Game. After I won my first national championship, my chess life started gathering momentum. My passion for the game fueled a long ride of unhindered learning and inspired performance. From 9 to 17, I was the top-ranked player for my age in the country. I won 8 individual national championship titles, captained my school to winning 7 team nationals, and represented America in 6 world championships. These were years of tremendous growth, and as I got deeper into the heart of chess, the art became a riveting window of self-exploration. A key ingredient to my success in those years was that my style on the chessboard was a direct expression of my personality. It's my nature to revel in apparent chaos. I've always loved thunderstorms, blizzards, hurricanes, rough seas, sharky waters. Since childhood, inclement conditions have inspired me, and as a young competitor, I would guide critical chess games into positions of tremendous complexity with the confidence that I'd be able to sort through the mayhem more effectively than my opponents. I often sensed a logical thread to positions that seemed irrational. Playing exciting chess felt like discovering hidden harmonies. I was a free-flowing performer, unblocked by psychological issues and hungering for creative leaps. One of the most critical strengths of a superior competitor in any discipline, whether we're speaking about sports, business negotiations, or even presidential debates, is the ability to dictate the tone of the battle. Many of my young chess rivals preferred to keep the game in control. They played openings that they'd memorized, played them over and over again. They hankered for rating points, calculated what the next result would do to their national ranking, and their materialistic dispositions made them uncomfortable in the stormy positions in which I thrived. Because of my classical chess education and my love for the endgame as well as crazy middle games, I was usually able to move the position toward one of my strengths. Things got a bit more complicated when I was 10 years old and started to compete almost exclusively in adult tournaments, only playing kids in the nationals or world championships. This was a big change because highly experienced tournament players could often guide the chess position into closed, strategical battles which were not to my liking. As I cultivated my strengths, I also had to take on the more abstract elements of high-level chess so I could compete effectively with more seasoned opponents. Just as muscles get stronger when they're pushed, good competitors tend to rise to the level of the opposition. The adult chess world toughened me up, made me introspective and always on the lookout for flaws to be improved on. A bonus to playing grown-ups is that whenever I competed in the Scholastic Nationals, I had tremendous confidence. These were only kids, after all. The transition to open tournaments also forced me to take on the issue of endurance. In Scholastic events, a single chess game rarely lasts more than 3 hours. In most adult competitions, each player has to make his or her first 40 moves in 2 hours, a 4-hour time control. Then there's an additional hour for each player for every succeeding 20 moves. If enough moves are played, a game can continue for what feels to a child like eternity. Older opponents know that kids have less stamina for long battles, so they sometimes made the games drag on to tire me out. Once in Philadelphia, a ruthless fellow made me play for over 9 hours. I was 10 years old and he sat stalling at the board in front of obvious moves for 45 minutes at a time. It was terrible, but a lesson learned. On top of everything else, I had to develop the ability to run a mental marathon. Chess was a constant challenge. My whole career, my father and I searched out opponents who were a little stronger than me, so even as I dominated the Scholastic circuit, losing was part of my regular experience. I believe this was important for maintaining a healthy perspective on the game. While there was a lot of pressure on my shoulders, fear of failure didn't move me so much as an intense passion for the game. I think the arc of losing a heartbreaker before winning my first big title gave me license to compete on the edge. This is not to say that losing didn't hurt. It did. There's something particularly painful about being beaten in a chess game. In the course of a battle, each player puts every ounce of his or her tactical, strategical, emotional, physical, and spiritual being into the struggle. The brain is pushed through terrible trials, We stretch every fiber of our mental capacity. The whole body aches from exhaustion after hours of rapt concentration. In the course of a dynamic chess fight, there'll be shifts in momentum, near misses, narrow escapes, innovative creations, and precise refutations. When your position teeters on the brink of disaster, it feels like your life is on the line. When you win, you survive another day. When you lose, it's as if someone has torn out your heart and stepped on it. No exaggeration. Losing is brutal. This brings up an incipient danger in what may appear to be an incremental approach. I've seen many people in diverse fields take some version of the process-first philosophy and transform it into an excuse for never putting themselves on the line or pretending not to care about results. They claim to be egoless, to care only about learning, but really this is an excuse to avoid confronting themselves. This issue of process versus goal is very delicate, and I want to carefully define how I feel the question should be navigated. It would be easy to read about the studies on entity versus incremental theories of intelligence and come to the conclusion that a child should never win or lose. I don't believe this is the case. If that child discovers any ambition to pursue excellence in a given field later in life, he or she may lack the toughness to handle inevitable obstacles. While a fixation on results is certainly unhealthy, short-term goals can be useful developmental tools if they're balanced within a nurturing long-term philosophy. Too much sheltering from results can be stunting. The road to success is not easy, or else everyone would be the greatest at what they do. We need to be psychologically prepared to face the unavoidable challenges along our way. And when it comes down to it, the only way to learn how to swim is by getting in the water. Let's put ourselves in the shoes of the mother of a talented young chess player I know named Danny. This 7-year-old boy just loves chess. He can't get enough. He studies chess for a half hour every day, plays on the internet, and takes lessons from an expert once a week. He's recently started competing in scholastic chess tournaments, and the mother finds herself swept away by the exciting atmosphere. She finds her own sense of well-being fluctuating with Danny's wins and losses. This woman is a substantial, sensitive, intelligent person, and she doesn't want to put an extra burden on her son's shoulders. She's aware of the entity incremental dynamic, and so when Danny loses, she wants to tell him it doesn't matter. But obviously it does matter. He lost and is sad. To tell him it doesn't matter is almost to insult his intelligence. What should she do? This real-life dynamic has parallels in virtually every field, although we're often our own parent in the moment. How can we balance long-term process with short-term goals and inevitable setbacks? Let's dive in. Danny is an intelligent boy who's decided to dedicate himself for the time being to chess. He loves the challenge of facing off with other young minds and stretching himself to think a little further and more accurately than he could the day before. There is nothing like a worthy opponent to show us our weaknesses and push us to our limit. It's good for Danny to compete, but it's essential that he do so in a healthy manner. First of all, in the spirit of the previous chapter, Danny's mom can help him internalize a process-first approach by making her everyday feedback respond to effort over results. She should praise good concentration, a good day's work, a lesson learned. When he wins a tournament game, the spotlight should be on the road to that moment and beyond, as opposed to the glory. On the other hand, it's okay for a child, or an adult for that matter, to enjoy a win. A parent shouldn't be an automaton, denying the obvious emotional moment to spout platitudes about the long-term learning process when her child is jumping up and down with excitement. When we've worked hard and succeeded something, we should be allowed to smell the roses. The key, in my opinion, is to recognize that the beauty of those roses lies in their transience. It's drifting away, even as we inhale. We enjoy the win fully while taking a deep breath. Then we exhale, note the lesson learned, and move on to the next adventure. When Danny loses, the stakes will feel a bit higher. Now he comes out of the tournament room a little teary. He put his heart on the line and lost. How should his mom handle this moment? First of all, she shouldn't say that it doesn't matter, because Danny knows better than that, and lying about the situation isolates Danny in his pain. If it didn't matter, then why should he try to win? Why should he study chess and waste their weekends at tournaments? It matters, and Danny knows that. So empathy is a good place to start. I think this mother should give her son a hug. If he's crying, let him cry on her shoulder. She should tell him how proud of him she is. She can tell Danny that it's okay to be sad, that she understands and that she loves him. Disappointment is a part of the road to greatness. When a few moments pass, in a quiet voice, she can ask Danny if he knows what happened in the game. Hopefully the language between parent and child will already be established, so Danny knows his mom is asking about psychology, not chess moves. Almost all mistakes have both technical and mental components. The chess lesson should be left for after the tournament, when Danny and his teacher study the games. Did he lose his concentration? Did he fall into a downward spiral and make a bunch of mistakes in a row? Was he overconfident? Impatient? Did he get psyched out by a trash talker? Was he tired? Danny will have an idea about his psychological slip, and taking on that issue will be a short-term goal in the continuing process. Introspective thinking of this nature can be a very healthy coping mechanism. Through these dialogues, Danny will learn that every loss is an opportunity for growth. He'll become increasingly astute psychologically and sensitive to bad habits. A heartfelt, empathetically present, incrementally inspiring mom or dad or coach can liberate an ambitious child to take the world by the horns. As adults, we have to take responsibility for ourselves and nurture a healthy, liberated mindset. We need to put ourselves out there, give it our all, and reap the lesson, win or lose. The fact of the matter is that there will be nothing learned from any challenge in which we don't try our hardest. Growth comes at the point of resistance. We learn by pushing ourselves and finding what really lies at the outer reaches of our abilities. As I matured as a chess player, there were constant leaps into the unknown. Because of my growth curve, my life was like that hermit crab, who never fits into the same shell for more than a few days. I would have to learn esoteric, initially uncomfortable types of chess positions. I would take on dangerous new rivals who recently immigrated from Eastern Europe or the Soviet Union. I'd travel to distant countries to compete and need to adapt to the alien cultural and chess customs and the spur of the moment. I remember when I was 11 years old, I went to Timișoara, Romania, to represent America in the World Championship for everyone under the age of 12. Each country sends their champion, and we go to battle. My dad and I had trouble finding the competition site on the opening day, and I arrived late to the first round. When I finally got to my seat across from the national champion of Qatar, there were 30 minutes already off my clock, a large disadvantage. To make matters worse, I didn't recognize any pieces on the chessboard. The untraditional chess set the Romanians had chosen for the tournament was completely bizarre to me. I was sitting in front of a game I'd never seen before, like one of my childhood nightmares where I couldn't remember how to move the pieces and cameras were flashing in my face. The moment was quite alarming. It turns out that I handled the situation pretty well. I took a few deep breaths, made my opening move, and played somewhere between blindfold and looking at the board. Chess was in my blood, even if that set was not. I moved quickly to catch up on the clock, calculated in my head as I had done so often in training, and won that first round without much trouble. Then I spent much of the evening getting used to the chess pieces and had an excellent tournament over the next 2 weeks. One of the more emotional movements in my young life came as I was turning 11 years old and had to make the painful transition away from my first teacher, Bruce Pandolfini. I loved Bruce. He was part of my family. But I was improving quickly, and he just wasn't a strong enough player to keep on coaching me. Bruce was a national master who hadn't been active in tournaments in years, and I was already approaching his level. We found a wonderful new coach, Chilean international master Victor Frias, who in time would become a very dear friend of my family. Breaking from Bruce felt like losing a part of myself. That same year, my father's brutally honest book, Searching for Bobby Fischer, was released around the world. It was a beautifully written account of our journey together, during my rise to winning my first national title, and years later it would inspire the Paramount film of the same name. I was already well known in the chess world, but now I was really out there, which put some extra pressure on my shoulders. I went on all the television shows with my awkward adolescent afro and goofy smile. Jane Pauley on the Today Show asked me whether I wanted to be like Bobby Fischer. Just then the music started playing, which meant I had 5 seconds to answer. And I knew Bobby Fischer was crazy, so I came out with a brilliant closer. No, I never want to be like Bobby Fischer again. Again? What is this kid talking about? I was having a great time, and was just innocent enough to avoid being messed up by the spotlight. I dove deeper and deeper into chess. Of course, there were plateaus, periods when my results leveled off while I internalized the information necessary for my next growth spurt. But I didn't mind. I had a burning love for chess, and so I pushed through the rocky periods with a can-do attitude. I became a chess master a few days after turning 13, beating Fischer's mark of 13 years, 5 months. People were saying that I was a future world champion, but I didn't hear them. I was a competitor who knew winning and losing and the hair's breadth between. My rivals didn't care about reputation. They just wanted to crush me, and I had to keep it real. There were a few powerful moments that reinforced my young notion that glory had little to do with happiness or long-term success. I'll never forget walking out of the playing hall at the 1990 Elementary School National Championships after winning the title game. There were over 1,500 competitors at the event, all the strongest young players from around the country. I had just won the whole thing, and everything felt normal. I stood in the convention hall looking around. There was no euphoria, the opening of the heavens. The world was the same as it had been a few days before. I was Josh. I had a great mom and dad and a cute little sister Katya, who was fun to play with. I loved chess and sports and girls and fishing. When I would go back to school on Monday, my friends would say, "All right," just like they did after hitting a jump shot. And then it would be in the past, and we'd go play football. Chapter 5. The Soft Zone. Lose Yourself. World Junior Chess Championship, Calicut, India, November 1993. I was 16 years old, sitting at a chessboard in Calicut, India. Sweat dripped down my sides as I battled to stay focused in the sweltering heat. The sun was high, the air still, the room stuffed with rustling world-class thinkers. I had traveled from New York City to represent America in the World Championship for Chess Players under the age of 21. Each country sent its national champion to compete in a grueling two-week marathon of pure concentration, endurance, calculation, strategy, all-out psychological war. My father and I had flown into Bombay a week earlier and traveled south to the event where I met my girlfriend, who was representing Slovenia in the women's division of the tournament. She was a brilliant girl, gorgeous, otherworldly, fiercely intense, moody, my first love. Tormented love and war, a complicated mix. Less than ideal for world championship competition, but the life of a top chess player is a strange one. Brutal competition mixes with intense friendships. Players try to destroy their opponents, to ruin their lives, and then they reflect on the battle, lick their wounds, cull the lessons, and take a walk. From one perspective, the opponent is the enemy. On the other hand, there's no one who knows you more intimately, no one who challenges you so profoundly or pushes you to excellence and growth so relentlessly. Sitting at a chessboard just feet away from the other, you can hear every breath, feel each quiver, sense any flicker of fear or exhilaration. Hours pass with your entire being tapped into your opponent's psyche, while the other follows your thoughts like a shadow and yearns for your demise. Brilliant minds all over the world devote themselves to the intense study of this mysterious, brutal intellectual sport, and then the best of them collide in distant outposts. Here I was in a strange, faraway land, sweating in the oppressive heat, trying to find my beloved art in the figurines in front of me. Above me, thousands of spectators hung from the rafters, whispering, staring at the chessboards like sutra. Somehow chess in India resonate like ancient lovers. I was disjointed, out of whack, not yet settled into the rhythm of the tournament. Even for the master, sometimes chess can feel like home, and sometimes it can be completely alienating, a foreign jungle that must be explored as if for the first time. I was trying to find my way home. Across from me was the Indian national champion, and between the two of us lay the critical position of our struggle. We were 3 hours into the battle, and I had been thinking for 20 minutes. A curious thing happened in that time. So far, I had been grinding my way through this game. It was the first round. I had no flow, no inspired ideas. The pieces were alien, the position strange. After about 10 minutes of thought, I began to lose myself in the variations. It's a strange feeling. First, you're a person looking at a chessboard. You calculate through the various alternatives, the mind gaining speed as it pours through the complexities, until consciousness of one's separation from the position ebbs away, and what remains is the sensation of being inside the energetic chess flow. Then the mind moves with the speed of an electrical current. Complex problems are breezed through with an intuitive clarity. You get deeper and deeper into the soul of the chess position. Time falls away. The concept of I is gone. All that exists is blissful engagement, pure presence, absolute flow. I was in the zone, and then there was an earthquake. Everything started to shake, and the lights went out. The rafters exploded with noise. People ran out of the building. I sat still. I knew what was happening, but I experienced it from within the chess position. There was a surreal synergy of me and no me, pure thought and the awareness of a thinker. I wasn't me looking at the chess position, but I was aware of myself and the shaking world from within the serenity of pure engagement. And then I solved the chess problem. Somehow the earthquake and the dying lights spurred me to revelation. I had a crystallization of thought, resurfaced, and vacated the trembling playing room. When I returned and play resumed, I immediately made my move and went on to win the game. This intense moment of my life was the launching point for my serious investigation of the nuances of performance psychology. I had used an earthquake to reach a higher state of consciousness and discover a chess solution I may not have otherwise found. As this book evolves, I'll gradually lay out my current methodology for triggering such states of creative flow. Eventually, by systematically training oneself, a competitor can learn how to do this at will. But the first obstacle I had to overcome as a young chess player was to avoid being distracted by random, unexpected events, by the mini-earthquakes that afflict all of our days. In performance training, first we learn to flow with whatever comes. Then we learn to use whatever comes to our advantage. Finally, we learn to be completely self-sufficient and create our own earthquakes, so our mental process feeds itself explosive inspirations without the need for outside stimulus. The initial step along this path is to attain what sports psychologists call the soft zone. Envision the zone as your performance state. You're concentrated on the task at hand, whether it be a piece of music, a legal brief, a financial document, driving a car, anything. Then something happens. Maybe your spouse comes home. Your baby wakes up and starts screaming. Your boss calls you with an unreasonable demand. A truck has a blowout in front of you. The nature of your state of concentration will determine the first phase of your reaction. If you're tense, with your fingers jammed in your ears and your whole body straining to fight off distraction, then you're in a hard zone that demands a cooperative world for you to function. Like a dry twig, you're brittle, ready to snap under pressure. The alternative is for you to be quietly, intensely focused, apparently relaxed with a serene look on your face, but inside all the mental juices are churning. You flow with whatever comes, integrating every ripple of life into your creative moment. This soft zone is resilient, like a flexible blade of grass that can move with and survive hurricane force winds. Another way of envisioning the importance of the soft zone is through an ancient Indian parable that has been quite instructive in my life for many years. A man wants to walk across the land, but the earth is covered with thorns. He has two options. One is to pave his road, to tame all of nature into compliance. The other is to make sandals. Making sandals is the internal solution. Like the soft zone, it doesn't base success on a submissive world or overpowering force, but on intelligent preparation and cultivated resilience. My relationship to this issue of coping with distraction began with the quirkiness of a 10-year-old boy. In the last chapter, I mentioned that as my chess understanding grew more sophisticated and I transitioned to adult tournaments, my games tended to last longer, sometimes going on for 6 or 8 hours. Kids have trouble focusing for so long, and strange things can happen to a young mind, straining, under intense pressure. One day I was working my way through a complex position in a tournament at the Manhattan Chess Club, and a Bon Jovi song I had heard earlier in the day entered my mind. I tried to push it away and return to my calculation, but it just wouldn't leave me alone. At first this seemed funny, but soon the music eclipsed the chess game. I couldn't think, and ended up blundering and losing. Soon enough, this problem became rampant in my chess life. If I heard a particularly catchy tune at home or on the way to a tournament, I would sometimes be haunted by it for days. This might sound trivial, but for me it was disastrous. There I'd be, 11 years old, facing down a wily old chess master, and the theme song from Ghostbusters would be hammering away in my brain. The more I tried to block out the distraction, the louder it would get in my head. As a young boy, I felt alone with this problem. But in recent years, while lecturing on performance psychology, I found that many high-stress performers have similar symptoms. Over time, as I became more and more fixated on irritating mental music, I started being bothered by noises I'd never even noticed before. In a silent playing hall, the sound of a distant ambulance or whispering spectators can be an uproar. A ticking chess clock can be a telltale heart, pounding like thunder in your mind. I was having terrible and hilarious noise problems, and then one day I had a breakthrough. I was playing a tournament in Philadelphia, with a Phil Collins song rattling away in my brain, when I realized that I could think to the beat of the song. My chess calculations began to move to the rhythm of the music, and I played an inspired game. After this moment, I took the bull by the horns and began training to have a more resilient concentration. I realized that in top-ranked competition, I couldn't count on the world being silent, so my only option was to become at peace with the noise. The victims of my training method were my parents and sister. A few times a week while studying chess in my bedroom, I blasted music. Sometimes it was music I liked, sometimes music I didn't like. For a period of many months, I blared booming Giotto monk chants, which drove my sister Katya to utter distraction. My family's little apartment was besieged by my bizarre training concept, and it's amazing they put up with me. My idea was to become at peace with distraction, whatever it was. During this period of time in my early teens, I frequented chess shops near my home and played speed chess in clouds of smoke, which I've always hated. Of course, I also played in Washington Square Park, where constant kibitzing and a steady stream of chess banter is part of the game. There was no blocking out the noise or smoke, and my only option was to integrate my environment into my creative process. So if Bon Jovi was playing, I might be prone to play a bit more aggressively than when I had on quiet classical music. The Giotto monk chants pounded me into fascinating chessic discoveries. Voices in the park inspired me as they had when I was a young boy. The smoke I learned to live with. As I turned 14 and then 15 years old, my soft zone training was really put to the test. The competition for the top of the American Scholastic Chess ranking was stiffened by a tremendous influx of Soviet immigrants. As the Soviet Union fell apart, many of the powerful Russian players looked for opportunity in the West. These kids were highly trained, excellent fighters, who'd been schooled in the famous Pioneers' Palaces of Moscow and Leningrad. Pioneers' Palaces were state-funded youth centers in the USSR, in which dedicated children were trained in specific disciplines. These schools were famous for pumping out highly professionalized young chess players. Most Pioneers' Palaces were shut down with the fall of the Soviet Union. Many of these new rivals were armed with a repertoire of psychological tricks that presented serious challenges. One of the more interesting tactics was implemented by a Russian boy, whom I had trouble with for a period of months before I caught on to his game. He was a very strong player, so our clashes were always tense, but for some reason I tended to make careless errors against him in the critical positions. Then one day an old Bulgarian master named Rudy Blumenfeld approached my father in the Marshall Chess Club and asked him if we were aware of what this boy was doing to me. We were not. He explained that in the climactic moments of the struggle, when I had to buckle down and patiently work my way through the complications to find a precise solution, this boy would start to tap a chess piece on the side of the table, barely audible, but at a pace that entered and slightly quickened my mental process. This subtle tactic was highly effective, and I later found out that it was an offspring of the Soviet study of hypnosis and mind control. The next time we played, I was on the lookout for the tapping, and sure enough, in the critical moment, it was right there. Hilarious. Once I was aware of what was happening, I was able to turn the tables in our rivalry. Some of the other young Russian players were far less subtle and had tricks that crossed the borders of sporting ethics. One of these boys, who was my arch rival for years, had the habit of kicking me under the table during the critical moments of a game. He would also get up from the board at tournaments and talk about the position in Russian with his coach, a famous grandmaster. There were complaints, but little was done to stop the cheating. No one could prove what was discussed because of the language barrier, and the truth is that it didn't even matter. While valuable chess ideas might have been exchanged, the psychological effect was much more critical. Opponents felt helpless and wronged. They took on the mentality of victim, and so half the battle was already lost. More than once I watched top young American players reduced to tears by this kid, but these dirty tactics were not reserved for local soil. In 1993, when we were 16, this Russian boy and I both traveled to India to jointly represent America in the World Under 21 Championship, and a formal protest was lodged against the American team by 7 or 8 delegations because he was blatantly cheating at the event. Competitors from all over the world approached me and demanded to know how the Americans could do such a thing. I was embarrassed to be associated with this kid and his seedy repertoire. As a result of this shift of tone in the U.S. scholastic scene, many of my American contemporaries became dispirited and quit the game. The Russian kids were great players who presented a whole new set of challenges, and instead of adapting and raising their games, American kids dropped out. For my part, this new crew of brilliant Machiavellian rivals made me buckle down. I had my home turf to defend, and the first step would be to learn how to handle dirty opponents without losing my cool. Sometimes noticing the psychological tactic was enough to render it harmless, but in the case of the kicking and barefaced cheating, I really had to take on my emotions. These breaks from etiquette were outrageous in the chess world, and I was appalled. The problem is that when I got angry, I was thrown off my game. I tried to stay level-headed, but this one rival of mine had no limits. He would push me to the point of utter exasperation, and I would often self-destruct. I've come to believe that the solution to this type of situation does not lie in denying our emotions, but in learning to use them to our advantage. Instead of stifling myself, I needed to channel my mood into heightened focus, and I can't honestly say that I figured out how to do this consistently until years into my martial arts career, when dirty opponents try to take out my knees, target the groin, or headbutt me in the nose in competition. My whole life, I've worked on this issue. Mental resilience is arguably the most critical trait of a world-class performer, and it should be nurtured continuously. Left to my own devices, I'm always looking for ways to become more and more psychologically impregnable. When uncomfortable, my instinct is not to avoid the discomfort, but to become at peace with it. When injured, which happens frequently in the life of a martial artist, I try to avoid painkillers and to change the sensation of pain into a feeling that's not necessarily negative. My instinct is always to seek out challenges as opposed to avoiding them. This type of internal work can take place in the little moments of our lives. I mentioned how my style over the board was to create chessic mayhem and then to sort my way through the chaos more effectively than my opponents. This was a muscle I built up by training myself to be at peace with the unclear and tumultuous, and most of the training was in everyday life. For example, since my teens, when I play cards, say gin rummy, I rarely arrange my hand. I leave the melds all over the place and do the organization in my head. I've never been a neat guy by nature, and I've furthered my messiness for years by consciously leaving my living area chaotic so I could practice organizing things mentally and being mellow in the madness. Of course, this process is never complete. As I'm writing this section, a lawnmower just went into gear right outside. A few minutes ago, I got up to close the window, but then I sat back down and left it open. The irony was too thick. Chapter 6. The Downward Spiral. Beginning when I was 18 years old, I spent 4 years coaching a group of talented young chess students at Public School 116 in New York City. The class usually consisted of about 15 children, but the core of the team was a group of 6 second graders, all friends, all enthusiastic, spirited learners, whose rowdiness was offset by a passion for chess. I loved those kids. We had wonderful times as I watched them grow, and eventually the team became city champions, state champions, placed second in the kindergarten through fifth grade national championships in 1999, and 2 of them won individual national titles. I'm sure that over the years I learned as much from those kids as they learned from me. There was something so refreshing in seeing their innate, unsullied curiosity, in contrast to the material ambition that moved most of my older chess rivals. One idea I taught was the importance of regaining presence and clarity of mind after making a serious error. This is a hard lesson for all competitors and performers. The first mistake rarely proves disastrous, but the downward spiral of the second, third, and fourth error creates a devastating chain reaction. Any sports fan has seen professional football, basketball, and baseball games won and lost because of a shift in psychological advantage. People speak about momentum as if it were an entity of its own, an unpredictable player on the field, and from my own competitive experience, I can vouch for it seeming that way. The key is to bring that player onto your team by riding the psychological wave when it's behind you and snapping back into a fresh presence when your clarity of mind begins to be swept away. With young chess players, the downward spiral dominates competitive lives. In game after game, beginners fall to pieces after making the first mistake. With older, more accomplished players, the mistakes are subtler, but the pattern of error begetting error remains true and deadly. Imagine yourself in the following situation. You're a highly skilled chess master in the middle of a critical tournament game and you have a much better position. For the last 3 hours, you've been pressuring your opponent, increasing the tension, pushing him closer to the edge, and searching for the decisive moment when your advantage will be converted into a win. Then you make a subtle error that allows your opponent to equalize the position. There's nothing wrong with equality, but you've developed a powerful emotional attachment to being in control of the game. Your heart starts to pound because of the disconcerting chasm between what was and what is. Chess players are constantly calculating variations and either accepting or dismissing them based on a comparison of how they evaluate the visualized position versus the original position. So, if you have an advantage, make an error, and then still cling to the notion that you have an advantage, then when you calculate a variation that looks equal, you'll reject that line of thought because you incorrectly believe it's moving you in the wrong direction. What results is a downward spiral where the foundering player rejects variations he should accept, pushing with hollow overconfidence for more than there is. At a high level, pressing for wins in equal positions often results in losing. As a competitor, I've come to understand that the distance between winning and losing is minute, and moreover, that there are ways to steal wins from the maw of defeat. All great performers have learned this lesson. Top-rate actors often miss a line, but improvise their way back on track. The audience rarely notices because of the perfect ease with which the performer glides from troubled waters into the tranquility of the script. Even more impressively, the truly great ones can make the moment work for them, heightening performance with improvisations that shine with immediacy and life. Musicians, actors, athletes, philosophers, scientists, writers understand that brilliant creations are often born of small errors. Problems set in if the performer has a brittle dependence on the safety of absolute perfection or duplication. Then an error triggers fear, detachment, uncertainty, or confusion that muddies the decision-making process. I often told my wonderful young students to beware of the downward spiral. I taught them that being present at critical moments of competitions can turn losses into wins, and I conveyed strategies for how to do this. Sometimes all the kids needed was to take 2 or 3 deep breaths, or splash cold water in their faces to snap out of bad states of mind. Other times, more dramatic actions were called for. If I felt dull during a difficult struggle, I'd occasionally leave the playing hall and sprint 50 yards outside. This may have seemed strange to spectators, but it served as a complete physiological flushing, and I returned, albeit a bit sweaty, in a brand new state of mind. As an 18-year-old, I had not yet refined my methodology for snapping into pure presence. This system is the subject of the chapter Building Your Trigger, in part 3 of the book. But I understood that avoiding the ripple effect of compounding errors had broad application. Then something happened in my life that drove this rule into my soul. It was my habit to walk the 2 miles to PS116 every Wednesday, planning my class and enjoying the city. One fall afternoon, I was strolling east along 33rd Street, lost in thought and headed toward the school. Everyone who's grown up in Manhattan knows that it's important to look both ways before crossing the street. Cars run lights, and bicyclists ride the wrong way down one-way streets. Drivers are used to narrowly avoiding bustling midtown crowds, and most New Yorkers are untroubled by the cacophony of sirens, blaring horns, and taxis speeding 10 inches in front of our noses. Things usually flow nicely, but the margin for error is slim. There I stood within the maelstrom of the midtown rush, waiting for the light and thinking about the ideas that I'd soon be discussing with my students. A pretty young woman stood a few feet away from me, wearing headphones and moving to the music. I noticed her because I could hear the drumbeat. She wore a gray, knee-length skirt, a black sweater, and the typical Manhattan office worker's white sneakers for the trek home. Suddenly, she stepped right into the oncoming traffic. I guess she was confused by the chaotic one-way street, because I remember her looking the wrong way down Broadway. Immediately as she stepped forward, looking right, a bicycle bore down on her from the left. The biker lurched away at the last second and gave her a solid but harmless bump. In my memory, time stops right here. This was the critical moment in the woman's life. She could have walked away unscathed if she had just stepped back onto the pavement, but instead she turned and cursed the fast, pedaling cyclist. I can see her now, standing with her back to the traffic on 33rd and Broadway, screaming at the now distant biker who had just performed a miracle to avoid smashing into her. The image is frozen in my mind. A taxicab was the next to speed around the corner. The woman was struck from behind and sent reeling 10 feet into the air. She smashed into a lamppost and was knocked out and bleeding badly. The ambulance and police came, and eventually I moved on to PS116, hoping that she would survive. As I walked into the school, dumbstruck by the severity of what I had just witnessed, I felt compelled to share a version of the story with my students. I left out the gravity of her injuries, but I linked chess and life in a way that appeared to move them. This tragedy needn't have happened. I explained how this woman's first mistake was looking the wrong way and stepping into the street in front of traffic. Maybe wearing headphones put her in her own world, a little removed from the immediacy of the moment. Then the biker should have been a wake-up call. She wasn't hurt, but instead of reacting with alertness, she was spooked into anger, irritated that her quiet had been shattered. Her reaction was a perfect parallel to the chess player's downward spiral. After making an error, it's so easy to cling to the emotional comfort zone of what was, but there's also that unsettling sense that things have changed for the worse. The clear thinker is suddenly at war with himself, and flow is lost. I've always visualized two lines moving parallel to one another in space. One line is time. The other is our perception of the moment. I showed my students these lines with my hands, moving through the air. When we're present to what is, we're right up front with the expansion of time. But when we make a mistake and get frozen in what was, a layer of detachment builds. Time goes on, and we stop. Suddenly we're living, playing chess, crossing the street with our eyes closed in memory. And then comes the taxicab. That chess lesson was surely the most emotional I've ever taught. 3 years later, my students and I traveled to the national championships in Knoxville, Tennessee. The kids were now in the 5th grade and one of the strongest teams in the country. In the final round of the tournament, we were tied for 1st place. I waited outside the tournament room with the parents of my kids. I always felt strange at a big game if I wasn't the one competing. But after years of teaching children and watching them grow into dynamic competitors, it felt especially harrowing to sit and wait for the verdict. Such experiences taught me that my father was not so misguided when he insisted that watching was more stressful than competing. So I waited for my students to emerge, joyous or distraught. Out came Ian Ferguson, a thoughtful boy with a wonderful introspective sensitivity and an eccentric talent for the game. He had won his game, and he ran over to me. We high-fived, and he said, "You know, Josh, I almost lost." Ian had a giddy, relieved expression on his face, but he also looked like he had seen a ghost. "I made a big mistake and hung my bishop. My opponent laughed, and I got really upset and reached for my queen. I was about to move, but then I remembered the woman and the bike. The move Ian was about to play would have lost his queen, and the game. But suddenly he remembered the lesson learned as a 7-year-old. He took a few deep breaths to clear his mind, came back to the moment, collected himself, and won a critical game in the national championships.